Let's all go to the
lava. Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come, join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs.
Projectionist, how do you feel about doing a tribute episode for Larry Cohen?
It seems as if we've been doing a number of those types of broadcasts of late, Victor.
Isn't that the truth? We lost John Carl Buechler last week.
He directed 1988 Cellar Dweller, yes?
He also directed Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood. But he was well known for his special effects work, too. The Dungeon Master, Reanimator, Trancers, Ghoulies, Troll, Eliminators, Dolls. He worked on quite a few movies that are considered cult films or cult classics. And now we've lost Larry Cohen.
Perhaps we should cover 1985's The Stuff on a future radio broadcast.
I wouldn't mind covering The Stuff, but we also have It's Alive, God Told Me To, and Q to name just a few of the films we could pick from. Personally, I would prefer to talk about It's Alive. I have some pretty vivid recollections of seeing the trailer at the 62 Drive-In.
I will naturally dim the lights in the auditorium this evening in their honor, sir.
Thanks, Projectionist. It's the least we can do. Hey, the recording light is on.
Hello there, dear listeners. And thank you for tuning into our latest Saturday Frights radio show, broadcast deep from the depths of the retroist vault.
It's a podcast, Projectionist. We're doing a podcast. Anyway, this time we were going to be tackling a requested film. The 1996 horror comedy by Peter Jackson, The Frighteners.
Yes, it would appear you enjoyed this picture more than I did.
Oh, come on now, Projectionist. I saw you laughing plenty of times when we screened it for the Retro's Vault staff last week.
There are some amusing moments, to be sure, but you were quite simply exaggerating my merriment at viewing this film.
Okay, okay. The Frighteners was a film that I was very much looking forward to back in the summer of 96. One of those reasons was that it had none other than Jeffrey Combs of Reanimator fame in a lead role. An actor, as we mentioned on the podcast episode for that very movie, I've always enjoyed. But to be honest, I've always been a big fan of Michael J. Fox too, from his work on the TV series Family Ties, and of course his film roles in the Back to the Future series, Teen Wolf, The Secret of My Success, and The Hard Way, to name a few.
Do not forget his role in 1982's Class of 1984, Sage.
That's right, Projectionist. Did you play The Frighteners at the Haunted Drive-In when it was released?
Most certainly. It failed, however, to find its audience.
Well, in hindsight, Universal Pictures releasing it in the summer with films like Twister, the first Mission Impossible, Eddie Murphy's remake of The Nutty Professor, and Independence Day wasn't the best time for a smaller budget horror comedy. Which is a shame, as no matter what my co-host might think, The Frighteners is a very good movie. To be fair, Universal Pictures originally intended it for it to open on October 31st of 96. But they were so impressed by what they saw in a rough cut, they felt the film could hold its own in the summer marketplace.
You know what they say about best intentions,
True, my friend. But there are plenty of good movies, like The Frighteners, that weren't able to find their audience when originally released. By the time the movie was set to come out, I was working at an upscale restaurant in my neck of the woods. The only 5-star restaurant, in fact. It was a member of the James Beard Foundation.
And they let the likes of you in their establishment.
Thanks, my friend. I had impressed the owner of the restaurant when he saw me working at the Razorback Theater. I hurtled over the concession stand one afternoon because we were understaffed, and the lines of the customers were backing up. I didn't have time to go all the way around to enter through the doorway.
What do you mean you hurtled over the stand, Sage?
There were railings to help lines form. So when I came down from the projection booth, I saw this group of 20 to 30 people. So I headed for the concession stand, built up a little speed, and placing a foot on the railing, leapt over the concession stand and opened up the second side to serve the theater goers.
Looking at you now, I'd have a hard time believing you could accomplish a sit-up, much less leap over the snack bar.
Ouch. Well, I was pretty spry back then. Anyway, at that point in my life, I was able to introduce my group of friends to the films of Jeffrey Combs, even having after-hour screenings at the restaurant with my coworkers. Sometimes I'd haul my Laserdisc player up to the restaurant and set everything up in the private room. Reanimator, From Beyond, Robot Jocks, Bride of Reanimator, Dr. Mordred, and Fortress were some of the films that Combs appeared in that were shown in those after-hour screenings. Of course, I showed more than just Jeffrey Combs films. But anyway, the point is that I was able to whip up a little excitement over Combs being in The Frighteners. And so we decided to see the film that weekend it opened as a group. We all showed up at a Saturday matinee and took our seats it was playing in. Kind of a small theater. But before the show began, I told everyone that when the credits at the beginning of the film started, when Jeffrey Combs' name showed up, everyone should applaud. So the film begins, and we are treated to that great opening, where the character of Patricia Ann Bradley is being stalked through the house by a supernatural entity, which we will later learn is the Grim Reaper. This vaguely humanoid shape appears to be traveling under the very carpet on the stairs, or just under the wallpaper, lunging out menacingly in an attempt to grab the frightened woman. After that thrilling intro, as the movie is set up proper, is when the cast names begin to appear. And you know how Murphy's Law works, right?
Oh dear.
Yeah, some people showed up late to the movie, and an extremely tall man walks in front of me right at the moment Jeffrey Combs' name appears on the screen. My group of friends and coworkers burst into applause, but I missed it. And to be fair, the guy probably wondered why everyone was applauding while he was trying to find his seat. Even with that missed opportunity to see Combs' name up on the big screen, a great time was had by all. Everyone seemed to appreciate the black comedy and jump scares of The Frighteners. Interestingly enough, The Frighteners was originally looked at as being a Tales from the Crypt film. With the success of 1995's Demon Knight,
which we discussed in an earlier broadcast, dear listeners.
Yes, we did. As I was saying, with the success of Demon Knight,
that was the episode where you made quite the fool of yourself over your fondness of Billy Zane, if I recall correctly.
While Bordello of Blood was chosen as the next Tales from the Crypt film, Robert Zemeckis, director of Used Cars, Romancing the Stone, the Pact of the Future series, Death Becomes Her, and Forrest Gump, to name a few, was also an executive producer for HBO's Tales from the Crypt series. Peter Jackson and his partner Fran Walsh came up with the idea of The Frighteners back in 1992. At the time, they were actually working on the script for 1994's Heavenly Creatures, which the duo would be nominated for at the Academy Awards for Best Original Screenplay, I should add. Jackson and Walsh wrote up a treatment, a three-page treatment for The Frighteners, and passed it along to their agent, who was able to get it in the hands of Zemeckis. Which is how, in January of 1993, they were hired to complete a feature-length script, which they did by January of the following year. It's been said that Robert Zemeckis was so blown away by the finished script that not only did he think it had the strength to stand alone, not part of the Tales from the Crypt film spin-offs, but that Peter Jackson himself should direct the movie.
Bear in mind, dear listeners, that Peter Jackson had already directed Bad Taste in 1987, with Meet the Feebles in 1989, and then 1992's masterpiece, Brain Dead, or Dead Alive, as it was known in America. Obviously, there was 1994's Heavenly Creatures, and then 1995's Forgotten Silver.
Yeah, I had been fortunate enough to have seen Peter Jackson's work before The Frighteners opened up, thanks to my local Hastings carrying his films on VHS. Being a college town, we were fortunate enough to have a place that catered to different tastes. I mean, you wouldn't find Meet the Feebles at the local Blockbuster. However, Forgotten Silver is a film that I've still not had the chance to see for myself. Quite frankly, at the time, I was totally unaware of its existence.
That might have had a little to do with it being a New Zealand television motion picture, Victor. It is a mockumentary that was co-directed by both Peter Jackson and Costa Bortz on a supposedly forgotten New Zealand filmmaker named Colin McKenzie, who had crafted his own motion picture camera, as well as supposedly originating the film techniques of the tracking shot, the use of close-ups, and he was the first to utilize sound and color in motion pictures. The ruse of this production was aided by having film historian Leonard Maltin appear in it, and even Harvey Weinstein of Miramax Films.
Of which Jackson would have closer dealings, stressful ones, with his Lord of the Rings films. I read that Costa handled the portions of the film that were of the documentary nature, with Jackson creating the faked lost footage elements. I've always felt that Peter Jackson has demonstrated his wonderful absurd humor. It appears that might have gotten away from him, as I've read he and Costa contacted a journalist before the mockumentary premiered, making it sound like as if Colin McKenzie had been a real filmmaker. When the duo confessed it was all a sham, a joke after the film premiered, it appears they got into some hot water over their jest. We got off subject there a bit, projectionist. So, I think Robert Zemeckis saw that Jackson could handle the rigors of helming The Frighteners himself. And rightfully so, as the film walks a fine line between horror and comedy, frequently combining both. Although, it has to be said that towards the end of the film, the laughs quickly dry up. Zemeckis would executive produce the film, with Universal Pictures giving it a budget of $26 million, as well as distributing it. It appears that Universal also felt so comfortable with both Jackson and Zemeckis that they granted them complete artistic control, and even the right of final cut. The Frighteners started shooting in May of 1995 in New Zealand, a stipulation that Universal agreed to as long as Jackson and his team could make it look like as if the film took place in the United States, which, judging by the flag in the sheriff's office, is meant to be somewhere in California. With Zemeckis as executive producer, it makes sense why he was quick to suggest Michael J. Fox as the lead in the film. And for what it's worth, I think that his role as Frank Bannister is probably one of Fox's best performances. He manages to blend the comedy perfectly with some heartfelt acting. His character of Frank Bannister is right from the get-go someone you can root for. Frankly, he's a shell of a man due to a personal tragedy, who, through that event, can now see, communicate, and in some cases, interact with the spirits of the dead.
I've heard rumors that if Michael J. Fox had passed on the project, they were willing to entertain the notion of casting Matthew Broderick or perhaps Tom Cruise for the part.
Huh, I hadn't heard that before, projectionist. I think Broderick could have done a great job, but I don't think Cruise would have been right for Bannister. Anyway, they also hired Trini Alvarado, probably best known for 1994's adaptation of Little Women to play Dr. Lucy Linsky, whose last name is a nod to actress Melanie Linsky, who appeared in Heavenly Creatures, and actually makes a cameo in Frighteners as a police deputy. There's Dee Wallace Stone of The Howling, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, and Cujo fame.
Do not forget 1991's Popcorn Sage.
I've not. We will definitely be covering that cult classic in the near future. Dee plays Patricia Ann Bradley, a character, as we've already mentioned, is first introduced being menaced by the villain of the film, the Grim Reaper. Then there is the iconic John Astin as the judge, a spectral gunslinger from Days of the Old West, who is one of the three spirits that Frank Bannister depends on to make a living as a psychic investigator and an exorcist. John is probably best known for his role as Gomez Adams in the 1960s The Addams Family TV series. Of course, this would not be the last time that Jackson would work with an Astin, as he cast John's adopted son, Sean Astin, for the role of Samwise Gamgee in his Lord of the Rings trilogy. Since we've begun to talk about Frank's ghost companions, there is Chai McBride, the chief in 2002's Undercover Brother, who plays Cyrus, a ghost decked out in 70s attire like he was an extra from Saturday Night Fever. The third ghost is Stuart, a nebbish spirit who appears to have died in his college days, as he is wearing what appears to be a varsity jacket.
I assumed that his character was meant to have been from the 50s.
Oh, good point, projectionist. Stuart is played by Jim Five, who, if you've seen John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness, he is the fan in the bookstore that confronts Sam Neill's character, warning him that Sutter Kane can see him. Peter Dobson plays Ray Linsky, the husband of Trini's character. Fun fact, Peter was cast in this role thanks to having previously worked with Robert Zemeckis in 1994's Forrest Gump, where he played the young Elvis Presley. Those of you who have seen The Frighteners, you will no doubt recall there is an Elvis joke in the film. This was indeed added because of Dobson's role from Gump, in addition to the fact the actor truly is an Elvis fan. Then there's the late and great R. Lee Ermey, who plays Sergeant Hiles, a guardian of the Fairwater Cemetery, obviously inspired by Ermey's role in Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket from 1987. Jackson and Walsh didn't exactly write the role with Ermey in mind, but after attempting to cast the character from actors in New Zealand, they felt they should at least offer him the role. The problem being they felt he would cost too much for what is basically a cameo, having him flown down to New Zealand for a couple of days. And I've heard they weren't sure he would even be interested in such a film. Obviously, they were pleasantly surprised that he was all on board with appearing in the movie. The maniacally charismatic Jake Busey plays a troubled young man from Patricia Ann Bradley's past, named Johnny Bartlett. Busey is probably best known for his role as Ace Levy from 1997's Starship Troopers, or possibly from Contact, also released in that same year. Troy Evans plays the good-natured Sheriff Walt Perry. Evans has a long list of credits, but he might be best known for his role as Roger Podactor in 1994's Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, or as the incredulous police chief who has lost his hotel reservation in 1998's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Evans is actually friends with our next actor, the one and only Jeffrey Combs, who plays the scene-stealing Agent Milton Dammers, who, when you get down to it, is almost as dangerous as the Grim Reaper, who, for reasons unknown, appears to have set his sights on the inhabitants of the fictional town of Fairwater. It's been said that Combs really put a lot of effort into his character, wearing black contact lens so that his eyes appeared off. I'm not talking shark eyes here, but I don't think it's a spoiler to say that Combs' portrayal of Milton is of a person who is 99.99% of the time about to lose his mind. This is a result of the character being put into so many undercover operations throughout the years in various cults, like as he mentions in the film, Spawn Ranch.
I was most delighted by Jeffrey Combs' performance, and as you have already pointed out, he did steal every scene he appeared in. You, dear listeners, might not know the significance of the Spawn Ranch reference. That would be where the infamous Charles Manson and his family stayed during the horrific crimes.
I can assure you, friends, that in The Frighteners, that part of Dammer's character isn't played for laughs. It's meant to chill you, show you how he became so messed up. Combs even had extensions placed on the back of his ears so they would stick out more. Plus, he's sporting an Adolf Hitler haircut. Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh weren't sure that Jeffrey Combs was still acting. Remember, this was in 1995, and it's not like you could quickly check the Internet Movie Database. Plus, they were also situated in New Zealand. But they were able to offer the role to Combs, as Jackson is a huge fan of 1985's Reanimator. There is one other element that makes The Frighteners work. The secret ingredient that helps to make it run like a well-oiled machine. That is, of course, the score by Danny Elfman. In 1995, Elfman had already made a name for himself with the scores to Pee-wee's Big Adventure in 85, Beetlejuice in 88, the iconic Batman score in 89. In 1990, he handled the scores for Nightbreed, Dick Tracy, Darkman, and Edward Scissorhands. And then in 1993, he delivered The Nightmare Before Christmas. For what it's worth, it appears that Elfman received some harsh reviews on the Frighteners score.
Perhaps Danny Elfman had reached the point of oversaturation. People were tired of hearing his distinctive themes in so many movies.
That is an interesting theory, and you might be right. I believe that over time, people have come to see that his work on The Frighteners was just as valid as any of the other films I just mentioned. Much like the movie itself, it took time to find its audience. I think it's time to jump into the synopsis for The Frighteners. If you've not seen the film for yourself yet, be warned, this is a complete synopsis filled with spoilers. I've already mentioned how the film starts strongly, with the attack on Patricia by the Grim Reaper. I should add this attack is stopped by the appearance of her deranged-looking and oppressively stern mother, toting a shotgun which she uses to blow the head off the carpeted entity. It's like it's wearing the carpet as a skin while it's choking her daughter.
Not that this action seems to have much effect, as the cloaked form of the Grim Reaper rushes at the screen. I'm sure to escape the wrath of Mrs. Bradley.
We should point out that Juliana McCarthy plays Mrs. Bradley. And while I do not recall them mentioning this in the movie, I've read she was the former head of the Fairwater Psychiatric Hospital. In fact, their ramshackled house is built in front of the now closed psychiatric facility.
There's a portrait of the deceased Mr. Bradley in the home. Perhaps it was he that was head of the facility during the tragedy that closed it down.
That's a good point. I think you're probably right. After that opening, we are introduced to Frank Bannister. He's attending a funeral, and thanks to a voiceover from two employees of the local newspaper, we understand that there has been a rash of mysterious deaths of late. Frank is at the graveside service not as a mourner, but in an attempt to drum up business. You see, Bannister advertises himself as a psychic investigator, with the ability to contact the dearly departed. Problem is, as you might imagine, most folks think he is a con man.
He is a huckster, Victor.
Yes, he actually is. But as I've mentioned, he can in fact communicate with spirits and such. Being seen as something of a pariah, he is physically ejected from the funeral service. While driving rather recklessly, he manages to crash through the fence of the Linsky's home, leading to an angry encounter with Ray, a health nut who is quick to become enraged, especially when Frank Bannister is involved. At this same time, his wife Lucy is making a house call to the Bradley residence, and afterwards she is quite worried about how much it looks like Patricia is being mentally and physically abused by her mother.
Oh, but dear listeners, you know that appearances can be deceiving, yes?
We'll get to that, my friend. The evening after Frank and Ray meet, Lucy is watching a VHS tape about serial killers. She's done a little research and was shocked to find that as a 15-year-old girl, Patricia had fallen in love with a psychopath named Johnny Bartlett, who went on a killing spree, murdering 12 people in 1964 in cold blood at the Fairwater Psychiatric Hospital. Patricia was seen as an accomplice, but due to her age, was spared the death penalty that Bartlett received, execution by electric chair. Instead, she was given life imprisonment, and as we learn, just 5 years previously, had been remitted to the care of her mother. Kind of a gruesome history to find out about the town you moved to 3 months earlier. But the Linskys have more on their mind as they appear to come under attack by a poltergeist. The bed is lifted and turned around. Objects begin to float through the room, including a statue of Elvis in front of Ray's stunned face. And what do you know? Just by chance, one of Frank Bannister's business cards has found its way into the folds of a bedsheet. So against her husband's wishes, Lucy calls Frank to see if he can help them, which Bannister is all too happy to do, informing them their place is quite haunted, and he can fix the issue with all of his professional gear. You know, a squirt gun full of holy water, an old radio that has been worked on to produce a brightly colored small bag that he claims houses the offending spirit, which can easily be destroyed by dropping it into a garbage disposal. And of course, his pink-colored dishwashing gloves.
It is almost as if Frank Bannister isn't exactly attempting to hide the fact he is conning clients, Victor.
You're sort of right. After all, he knows he's going to be paid, thanks to the hard work of Cyrus and Stuart. If a client wouldn't pay, I would imagine he would let his otherworldly associates continue to break things and scare people until they were forced to call him back. As you can guess, Ray is barely able to contain his rage at having Frank in the house after the fence issue earlier. But Bannister tries to smooth things over by waiving his normal fee of nearly $500 if they just forget about that little accident earlier. And while Frank was expecting certain things to have happened in the home, with Cyrus and Stuart performing a haunting, he's not expecting to see something appear on Ray's forehead. You see, Ray had a compress pressed against his head when Bannister entered the room. The young man at this point has lost his patience and is about to eject Frank from his home. Bannister, though, sees a glowing number on Ray's forehead. What, in fact, looks to be a carved number 37. Frank is really shaken by this, and we will learn why just a little bit later. He's hastily escorted from out of the house, and as we see as Bannister returns home...
Can you even call the place that Frank Bannister lives a home, Serge? There are no windows. Plastic tops are covering unfinished walls, and water drips from openings in the very ceiling.
Remember what I said earlier about Frank being a shell of a man. Due to the tragedy that occurred, he's just given up on practically everything. That tragedy was the death of his wife. And giving up includes the construction of the dream house he was working on when she passed away 5 years earlier. As we are quick to learn, the arrangement between Frank and Cyrus and Stuart isn't exactly smooth sailing. Cyrus in particular is upset at how Bannister is treating them, making them do heavy lifting of the Linsky's bed and such. I'm going to jump ahead a little and reveal that ghosts who have been around for a bit can perform hauntings. It appears to take some effort though. For example, Stuart, who is flustered by the ordeal, finds himself getting stuck in the middle of Frank's front door. The spirits themselves are a sort of luminous blue. They are see-through and were inserted into the scenes later by computer. So when Michael J. Fox is talking to Cyrus, Shy wasn't actually next to him. The spirits of Cyrus and Stuart appear to be slowly decaying, with what looks to be ectoplasm stains running from their eyes, nose, mouth, and ears.
Judging from the appearance of John Aston's The Judge, the longer the spirits remain, the worse they look.
True. That makeup design for the judge was handled by none other than Rick Baker. The judge appears to have been a lawman from the days of the Old West. Patches of his skin have peeled away to reveal the bone beneath. His jawbone, in fact, has a bad tendency to fall right off, which the ghostly form of an old dog has no problem stealing and chewing on. I'm going to assume the old hound dog originally belonged to the judge, but Aston's character's entrance, enraged by the dog stealing his jawbone, as he enters, he's firing off bullets from his six shooters. While these bullets, which are made up of ectoplasm, have no effect on Bannister beside unnerving him, the likes of Cyrus and Stuart run for cover, with Stuart actually getting grazed by one of the bullets, and we can see it definitely hurts him. So, while the spirits and frighteners are almost like cartoons, when they are hit with everyday objects, they just shake it off, a ghost can most definitely harm another ghost. After an aborted attempt at a haunting, thanks to the editor of the local newspaper, Magda Rees-Jones, played by Elizabeth Hawthorne, who proudly puts on the front page of the paper that Bannister is a con man. Frank is shocked to discover that Ray Linsky has died. He makes his way to the funeral after seeing Lucy riding in a hearse and learns from Sheriff Walt that besides Lucy, Frank was the last to see Ray alive. Walt is friendly with Frank and kind of appears to be the only one in town who thinks he's an okay guy. Strange, but okay. Bannister isn't as interested in the sheriff's conversation as he is at the ghostly form of Ray Linsky being in attendance at his own funeral. By the way, the scenes in the cemetery were shot in an actual cemetery. Peter Jackson has said that over the years, headstones had been moved around the cemetery as it had been expanded. But the exact locations of where the coffins had been buried had been lost. So, When they dug the hole for the coffin to be lowered in that scene, they weren't exactly sure what they would find while digging. Once the job was done, Jackson was informed that where the crew had stopped digging, it felt a little hollow underneath. Obviously, Jackson and the crew were quick to shoot the scene and refilled the hole as quickly as possible. The digger apparently found the handle of a coffin that he gave to Jackson. Back to the synopsis. Ray was a picture of health, but it appears as if he died of a heart attack. Bannister is a little miffed that it looks like Ray is going to start following him around, even asking that when he died, why didn't he go into the Tunnel of Light? Ray says he didn't because he felt he was too young to die. As Frank is walking through the cemetery towards his beat-up vehicle, he's able to explain a few things to Ray. And we see some of the inhabitants of the cemetery, from all decades popping up to watch Frank and Ray walk by. This is really freaking out Ray, but Bannister explains that they're not going to hurt him. And this is when we find out. Not only does most of the town of Fairwater not care for Frank, but some of the deceased don't like him either. And in the case of the cemetery guardian, Sergeant Hiles, he gladly shows he can physically harm Frank.
What's going on out here? Get back in your grave!
Ah, son of a...
Holy Jesus! Frank Bannister!
Go ahead, I'll handle this.
What are you doing in my graveyard? You have been told to stay away! Sound off like you've got up here!
Yeah, well, it's a public place, Hiles.
I do not like you! You cannot bring your spooks in here without my permission! Disappear, scumbag!
You!
I am not one of your explanations, Bannister! You cannot push spirits around! You are scum, using spooks to put the frighteners on people! That makes me physically ill! We got a lot of lowlifes around here, and I will provide an armed response to the first sign of trouble! They must be contained!
Get you later, Hiles.
My tour of duty runs another 85 years! There's a piece of dirt up here with your name on it, Bannister! I'm waiting for you, you little maggot!
Now then, Frank and Ray both are surprised when Lucy approaches Bannister, asking for help in contacting her departed husband. Over dinner, she reveals that things weren't going so well in their marriage, which is a shock to Ray, but she needs to know where her husband had invested a chunk of their finances. Big shock, he blew it on a bad business deal. As Ray realizes that Frank and Lucy seem to have the beginnings of an interest in each other, he gets upset, managing to knock over a wine glass and spilling its contents onto Frank. Using the bathroom to dry himself off, Bannister is startled when a man comes in to use the facilities, because this man has the number 38 carved into his forehead. Frank is sure something supernatural is going on now, and he's proven right when moments later he sees the Grim Reaper, a dark form in a tattered cloak, appear out of the bathroom mirror and shove its decaying hand in the stranger's chest, killing him by squeezing his heart. It's now that Frank realizes that somehow the Grim Reaper has shown up in Fairwater and is picking people off. Frank rushes out of the restaurant and is quick to attempt to chase down the deadly spirit, following it as he watches it sort of hop and glide over the roofs of businesses and homes. While we don't see it, someone obviously finds the body of victim number 38, and the police are called in. Lucy is brought to the station to answer Sheriff Walt's questions, and it's not exactly painting a pretty picture for Frank, him having fled the scene. Worse yet, due to all of these mysterious deaths, the FBI have sent in Special Agent Milton Dammers, who very much thinks Frank Bannister is the lead suspect, and is able to reveal more about that tragedy from Bannister's past, such as the handyman helping the Bannisters build their dream house witnessed on the day of Deborah Bannister's death the two of them having an argument, the reason being that Frank had promised his wife a garden at the new home. Instead, he used the space to build himself a personal basketball court. It's revealed that Bannister, 5 years earlier, was a successful building contractor. And we see in the flashback that in the trunk of the car the couple drove away in, there was a toolbox with a box cutter inside that happened to have Frank's initials in the handle.
Now, by Bannister's own admission, the argument continues to rage, reaching a climactic point when Deborah demands that Bannister stop, pull over, let her out, and at that moment, probably 12:37 p.m., the car leaves the road on a sharp curve. Proceeds presumably because Bannister was driving too fast.
She was killed?
Body was found some 15 yards from the car. Now, Bannister, he was picked up 2 hours later wandering in the woods. He claimed to have no recollection of the events that occurred after the accident. But here's the odd thing, Mrs. Linsky. His utility knife was missing. And to this day, it has not been found. But do you know what was really bizarre? Deborah's corpse had the number 13 carved into his forehead. Unlucky for some.
While Lucy is learning this, Frank, the judge, Cyrus, and Stuart are discussing what Bannister witnessed in the restaurant bathroom. That's when Frank sees a glowing portal of light appear above the local museum, signaling that someone has just died. He arrives to find that another victim has been killed. Actually, the young newspaper employee from the opening narration scene. Magda Reese Jones, having watched her employee die of what would look like a heart attack to her, begins to verbally attack Bannister. To his dismay, he sees the glowing number 40 carved into her forehead as she approaches him. Things quickly get out of hand as the police arrive, and as Bannister is wanted for questioning, it looks like things are about to turn violent, especially when the Reaper appears within the museum, looking to cut short the life of Magda. Thanks to the timely arrival of the judge, who uses his six-shooters and their ectoplasmic bullets to drive the Reaper away, as well as Cyrus and Stuart drawing the attention of the officers by using the remains of an actual mummy on exhibit, Frank almost makes a clean getaway. Sadly, while the judge is celebrating his apparent success, firing those trusty six-shooters in the air, the Reaper reappears, draws out a scythe, and cuts the lawman in twain. Magda attempts to block Frank's escape, and realizing that the misguided woman is next, Bannister ends up abducting her, attempting to flee from the pursuing Reaper in his car, where in a near recreation of the events leading up to his wife's death, he ends up crashing it, gaining consciousness just long enough to see the Reaper grab Magda's heart and crush it before escaping into the night. Frank, in a stunned state, shows up at the police station to inform Sheriff Walt that Magda is dead and where to find her body, which results in Frank being arrested and then brutally questioned by Agent Dammers. The agent believes that Bannister is somehow using supernatural abilities to kill people, especially those who have angered him. You'll remember he had gotten into an argument with Ray the previous day, and since Magda was slandering his name and they had had verbal altercations, he used his psychic gifts to stop her heart, too.
Jeffrey Combs plays Special Agent Milton Dammers masterfully. You are equal parts tickled by his antics, and then he can turn around and bring very real menace to his performance.
I agree with that, projectionist. Like I've said before, he steals the show in every scene he appears in. Thankfully, Lucy has the insight to see that Frank isn't the murderer. She decides to do a little investigating of her own, visiting Bannister's house, in fact. Now, the projectionist told you how this is a house in only the loosest sense. But as Lucy is wandering the decrepit place, she finds that where the basketball court was is now a beautiful garden. It's immaculate, and we can see the basketball hoop is vine-covered and rotting. This scene, married with Danny Elfman's moving score, never fails to make me tear up something fierce. Peter Jackson does a wonderful job with this moment, showing that Bannister may have given up on everything, but doing right by what he promised his wife before her death.
I will admit, I too felt a little stirring in my chest at this very scene, Victor.
It's hard not to be moved at that moment. Lucy sees this as confirmation that Frank is indeed a good man. The moment is interrupted, though, when his answering machine picks up a call from a very distressed Mrs. Bradley, asking for him to come to her house at once and help put down the evil spirit that is harassing her daughter. With Bannister in jail, it's up to Lucy to go check everything out. She doesn't realize it, but Ray has been following her. And when she drives up to the Bradley home, he is horrified because the house looks to be a breathing and malevolent entity.
Due to the evil that is residing within the domicile.
Absolutely. Patricia is surprised to find Lucy show up and is quick to hide her from Mrs. Bradley, leading her upstairs to her mother's room. There, Lucy finds that Patricia is more than a little guilt-stricken over her part in the tragedy at the psychiatric hospital. As they talk, she clutches an urn that houses her father's ashes, who died while she was in prison. Lucy is forced to hide in Mrs. Bradley's closet, and while Patricia leads her mother downstairs, Lucy finds Frank Bannister's missing box cutter in Mrs. Bradley's closet.
It would appear that Mrs. Bradley has a reason for being so off-putting to visitors, eh?
Like you said, appearances can be deceiving. Lucy is able to sneak out of the Bradley home, never realizing the entire time she was being stalked by the Reaper. Ray, while throughout the film, shows many examples that he wasn't a very nice guy or a good husband, pleads for his wife to leave the home, and, as he turns around, is attacked by the Reaper, who literally swipes with a taloned hand and rips off Ray's face. Lucy doesn't realize it, but when she gets into her car to drive to the police station, the skinned remains of Ray are thrown onto the hood of her vehicle. Lucy demands for a guard to let her see Bannister to explain to him that she has proof that he had no hand in his wife's death. Frank is practically comatose, but she is able to snap him out of it. Just in time, too, because as Bannister realizes in horror, she now has the number 41 carved into her forehead. Bannister is forced to attempt to keep her safe inside that tiny jail cell, pulling her away from the Reaper's clutching hands, although at one point it manages to grasp the poor woman's heart, briefly, before Stuart and Cyrus are able to pull it out of the cell. Here's the truth, though. It's too powerful for them, and the Reaper slays Stuart by slamming its scythe blade through his head, then reaching within him and grasping his, well, I guess you can call it his very soul, and crushing it in its withered claw-like hand. This, of course, angers Cyrus, who is able to hold off the Reaper long enough for Frank and Lucy to escape the jail cell by kicking the door into the guard as Lucy calls for help. But Cyrus is also slain by the Reaper as they flee. Frank quickly realizes there's only one way he's going to be able to protect Lucy. He needs to die, and he's about to put a bullet in his head to do that very thing when she reminds him she's a doctor and has a better plan. She brings him to the Fairwater Hospital, where she induces hypothermia so Bannister can have an out-of-body experience. He's only to be put under for 10 minutes to avoid permanent damage. The problem is, Agent Dammers has followed Lucy from the jail cell, and he thinks they should let him die. So not only is Frank having to contend with the Reaper, who very much wants to kill Lucy, but she is abducted by Dammers, taken to the local cemetery. When the Reaper shows up, he is confronted by Sergeant Hiles, who is slain by the entity after summoning up some very large guns. The Reaper is quick to attack Lucy in Dammer's vehicle, but Bannister is able to physically pull the entity off of her, and then Frank uses the summoned guns of Sergeant Hiles to dispatch the Reaper, firing off ectoplasmic bullets, shooting it to pieces until it's revealed that the Reaper is actually Johnny Bartlett. He somehow managed to escape from hell, and has been over the past 5 years, adding to his number of victims. You'll remember that he killed 12 back in 1964, and Frank's wife was found with the number 13 carved into her forehead. Lucy manages to escape from Dammer's car and the agent himself, while Bannister attempts to stop a fleeing Bartlett, who has turned into a black and vile oozing liquid, dripping into a crypt beneath the cemetery. Bannister is almost ready to destroy the supernatural killer, using the madman's own summoned scythe, when Lucy is able to resuscitate him back at the hospital. Obviously, Lucy has felt the pain of Bartlett's attack, so when Frank reveals that Johnny is the one behind all the killings, she believes him, and they figure that he is the one that has been trying to attack Patricia. Fearing for the woman's safety, Lucy's able to make it to the Bradley home first, and attempts to convince Patricia to leave. The woman, though, believes they need to wait on her mother, who's getting ready upstairs before leaving. It doesn't take long for Lucy to realize that Patricia isn't acting right. It's like she's talking to someone else, which she is. While Lucy can't see the ghost of Bartlett, he is there egging his love on to kill Lucy. Patricia was never an innocent, and she is just as crazy as her executed lover. She was the one to carve the number 13 in Deborah Bannister's forehead. In fact, as we learn later, she's the one responsible for carving the numbers into all the victims' foreheads during the attack on the psychiatric hospital. Fun fact, as originally planned, it would have been revealed that Patricia caused Frank and Deborah's car crash by placing a log on the road, forcing Frank to swerve to miss it. Remember, we had been told she had been released from prison 5 years ago, which lines up at the same time as Deborah's death. One of the reasons that Jackson hired D. Wallace Stone was he felt that most people would remember her for her role in E.T., and they wouldn't think she was the killer at first. As Patricia excuses herself to have a more private talk with the spirit of Bartlett in the kitchen, and to select the perfect knife to kill the young woman with, Lucy stumbles upon Mrs. Bradley, who has been murdered in her own bedroom. Lucy is attacked by Patricia, and like in the beginning of the movie, is menaced by Bartlett as he inhabits paintings and even the carpet. Frank luckily arrives and is able to stop Johnny, destroying the physical vessel he was inhabiting, the painting I just mentioned. Bartlett's spirit is freed, and Frank watches it drawn like a magnet to the urn Patricia was so protective of. Yeah, it's not her father's ashes, but Johnny's. Having accidentally trapped him within the urn, Frank explains they have to take it to Holy Ground. Thanks to her research on Patricia, Lucy knows there was a chapel in the psychiatric hospital behind the house. With an enraged Patricia following them, toting a shotgun, the duo enter the abandoned facility. Perhaps due to his recent encounters with death, Frank finds his sense of reality ping-ponging back and forth from the past to the present at the most inopportune times. He is able to see Johnny and Patricia committing their horrible murders. He has no control of these flashbacks, which is a problem, as Patricia is hunting him and Lucy. And Dammers has also arrived on the scene. Lucy and Bannister are separated, with Frank finding the chapel, but Dammers ends up getting his hands on the urn, mocking Frank as he pours the ashes out, releasing Johnny Bartlett. Milton doesn't have much time to gloat, as after shooting Frank in the arm, he's surprised by Patricia, who blows his head off. The gruesomeness of this scene is made hilarious by allowing we viewers a moment to see the ghostly face of Dammers looking incredibly confused at what has just occurred. Bannister and Lucy make their way to the basement of the former hospital, where Patricia assaults Frank, using her shotgun to choke the life from him. Bartlett, meanwhile, is keeping Lucy pinned to the ground, letting her watch as Frank dies.
It certainly looks like the end for our heroes.
Frank, having died for the second time that day, manages to pull Patricia's spirit from her body, and as the tunnel of light appears, holding onto her, he drags her into it and upwards to their final judgment. Bartlett, though, also leaps into the tunnel and manages to snatch Patricia away from Bannister. Frank arrives in heaven, finding two old friends waiting for him, Cyrus and Stuart, who tell him to step away from the edge of the tunnel. We see Patricia and Bartlett, meanwhile, laughing and promising they're going to head back and continue their killing spree, starting with Lucy.
That is when the tunnel of light, radiant blue and white, shifts to something far more organic and red. Tendrils with snapping jaws appear and begin to plunge themselves through the frightened and pained Johnny Bartlett and Patricia and Bradley, before it is revealed they are within the maw of a giant worm who snaps its jaws shut and plunges headfirst into the fiery pits below.
Frank assumes he has found his eternal reward, especially when Deborah Bannister appears, smiling at him, telling him he has to go home. Stuart explains briefly to Frank that they've been informed this isn't his time, and as Cyrus pushes him down back to Earth, he asks his friend to begin living now, with Deborah adding, she wants him to be happy. Awaking in Lucy's arms, the two share a kiss. And we next see that Bannister is having his former dream home demolished, burying the past so that he and Lucy can have a fresh new future. While Lucy and Frank are sharing a romantic lunch, they are interrupted by Sheriff Walt, who explains they found a whole stack of Ouija boards in Patricia's room. Walt would seem to be a believer about Bartlett being the killer, because he figures that as soon as the woman was released from prison, she made contact with him, so they could continue to rack up more kills. The sheriff even asks for Frank's help in writing a book about the whole situation. But Bannister says he should probably be talking to his guardian angel, pointing to Walt's empty patrol car. The sheriff turns, expecting to see something, and then laughs as he realizes Bannister is pulling his leg. Although, as he drives off, we can see a very angry spirit of Agent Milton Dammer glaring at Frank from the back seat of the vehicle. Lucy remarks how angry Dammer looks, and shocks Frank, with revealing she too can now see spirits. She explains, like Bannister did earlier, that people who have gone through a traumatic experience have been known to see spirits afterwards. Picking up the picnic blanket, she playfully drapes it over her head, making an appearance similar to the Reaper, and chases Frank as the credits roll. And that is the full and far too long synopsis of The Frighteners.
At the very least, if any of our dear listeners still have their radios tuned to the Retroist channel, they'll never have to watch the film for themselves.
Sorry, friends. When I really dig a movie, I have a tendency to want to share every bit of it, because
I have a question I would like to see if you could answer about The Frighteners.
Okay. I don't know if I'll be able to help, but I'll try.
When Frank Bannister reaches heaven, he sees the likes of Stuart and Cyrus, and even his dear departed wife.
Yeah?
Why not the judge, then? He was slain by Johnny Bartlett in the guise of the Reaper in the museum. Why was he not seen in this afterlife?
I can answer that question, Projectionist. It's because, as originally written and filmed, the judge wasn't killed by the Reaper in the museum. He was cut in half, but Bartlett didn't have the opportunity to finish him off. In fact, in a deleted scene, he's walking about on his hands as his legs go wandering aimlessly off. In the cemetery scene where Frank is attempting to stop Johnny from killing Lucy in the back of Agent Dammer's car, it's the judge that climbs onto the hood and blasts the serial killer in the face, before Bannister is able to use those massive guns to blast the guise of the Reaper away. So, that was a long way around to answer your question why the judge wasn't in heaven. He didn't die. In another deleted scene, meant for the end of the movie, we see the judge tied to his old hound dog and is heading off into the sunset, a fate worthy of an old West lawman, I reckon.
Interesting. I cannot help but wonder why they excised those scenes.
Peter Jackson has said he didn't feel that it actually served the overall narrative of the movie, which, in this case, I agree with him, to be honest. And I think that is about all we can say about 1996's The Frighteners. Don't you think, Projectionist?
I have nothing further to add.
Friends, we truly thank you, as always, for taking time to listen to the Saturday Frights podcast. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retrowest.com. My co-host, the Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. You can generally find him sharing old movie posters and newspaper advertisements throughout the week, and it's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. As for myself, you can find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too, and even sharing my love of retro things on the Retroist site. Every once in a while, I even have time to share some things on the Retroist Clubhouse on Facebook. If you'd like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at vicsage@retroist.com. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting the podcast, but for creating a place where we can all share in our love of things retro. So when you need your retro fix, and we all do, make sure to visit the Retroist. If you do enjoy the show, consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes and Stitcher to help spread the word. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
This is KAB Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here.
And let me be the first to wish Antonio Bay a happy birthday. We're 100 years old today.
And keep a watch out for that fog bank heading in from the east.
This has been a Retroist production. Sleep well and goodbye.